Welcome to this Forthright Radio for March 7th, 2012. I'm Joy LeClaire. We have a very full show for you today. With us for the full hour is Stanford University History of Science Professor Robert Proctor. We'll be speaking with him today about his latest book just out from the University of California Press, Golden Holocaust, Origins of the Cigarette Catastrophe and the Case for Abolition. This topic is far from being ho-hum, hasn't this all been said before? It is very relevant, particularly as the climate change deniers use the same tactics that the cigarette industry invented decades ago to cast doubts on the mortal danger, obfuscating the need for timely action. And even if you don't smoke and never have, your life has been impacted your whole life by the whole all-pervasive culture created by Big Tobacco in ways that are likely to surprise you. So don't turn that dial. Professor Robert Proctor specializes in 20th century science, technology, and medicine, especially the history of controversy in those fields, and projects on scientific rhetoric, the cultural production of ignorance, agnotology, and the history of expert witnessing. He also does work on human origins, including changing notions of the oldest tools, art, and fire, changing body imagery, the history of molecular anthropology, changing archaeological techniques, and images of humanness, the history of global creationism and Evo Devo, catastrophic geology, global climate change, and environmental policy. Some of his earlier books include Racial Hygiene, Medicine Under the Nazis, Cancer Wars, How Politics Shapes What We Know and Don't Know About Cancer, and Value-Free Science, Purity and Power in Modern Knowledge. He is a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and he was a senior scholar in residence at the U.S. Holocaust Research Institute. I could go on listing his accolades and accomplishments, but I'll stop here and simply add, welcome to Forthright Radio, Professor Robert Proctor.
Thank you, Joy.
Well, thank you for joining us today. We had actually originally scheduled you to be on last month, but you were held over for extra time while testifying in a tobacco industry case. Would you very briefly say what that involved?
Well, I testify as an expert witness against the tobacco industry in court, and the most recent case actually just reached a verdict yesterday, and the plaintiffs being awarded $41 million. And, you know, the industry opposes my testimony and tries to suppress it in various ways, and you never can tell when you're going to be called up, so that's what happened.
Yes, well, we're very glad that you were able to make it today. Now, as far as your book, Golden Holocaust, Origins of the Cigarette Catastrophe and the Case for Abolition, that's a very provocative title. To refer to the cigarette industry as a holocaust, a catastrophe, much less call for abolition. How do you defend your choice of words? Do you mean them metaphorically or literally?
Well, in a way, everything's a metaphor. But we're certainly talking about an unprecedented catastrophe. There were only about 100 million people died from smoking in the 20th century, but now we're on pace to have about a billion people die of smoking worldwide. And it's really the deadliest artifact in the history of human civilization. And to use anything but strong language is really falsifying the actual history.
Yeah, yeah. And as you say in your book, the choice of the word Holocaust is actually quite appropriate because that refers to fire, which
yeah.
is, of course, the crucial element in producing cigarette smoke.
Yeah, there's the sense of total burning and sacrifice. And, of course, there are obvious differences between the murder of 6 million Jews under the Nazis, and the more the partly self-imposed annihilation from cigarettes. But in terms of the magnitude, and the penetration and the apathy, it really is a gigantic catastrophe that people don't sufficiently appreciate.
Yes, yes. That's a shocking figure, 100 million people killed by tobacco smoke in the 20th century. That is, I think people are maybe a little inured to that. We, as a culture, we have sort of accepted a certain amount of deaths involved. Among the many surprising things in your book, however, is the estimate of 20,000 spontaneous abortions per year, and possibly as many as seven times that due to smoking. That's yeah. every year. And approximately 700 people killed every year from fires that start with cigarettes. I
yeah,
think
of course,
part of our nonchalance about it is the idea that individuals choose to smoke and therefore they assume a certain liability for themselves, but this is innocent victims.
Yeah, no, that's right. And of course, those figures you mentioned are just for the U.S. You've got to multiply by about 10 to get the world totals. And that's one of the big myths, is that smoking is a free choice, when in fact we know that it's actually at least as addictive as heroin or cocaine, and that most smokers, the overwhelming majority, wish they didn't smoke. So it's actually not even an issue of liberty. The tobacco industry has sort of captured the high ground of liberty and freedom and leaving its critics the remnants of longevity and so forth. But it's not even a free choice is I think one of the key points. Most smokers wish they didn't smoke. They think they're going to quit. And the people who enjoy smoking are actually so rare, the industry calls them enjoyers. And that's what I think most non-smokers don't realize, is that the smokers themselves wish they didn't.
Yeah. Now, you say that cigarettes are defective in the legal sense of the word. Explain what you mean by that.
Well, I was asked once in a trial, you know, Professor Proctor, do you think that cigarettes are inherently dangerous? And I sort of wondered. I thought this sounded like a trick question. And so I looked into it, and it actually turns out they're not inherently dangerous. They're dangerous by design, in a sense. They're kept dangerous because the industry refuses to make designs that would be actually substantially less deadly. They really don't care how deadly they are. And so they're defective because there are lots of things you could do that would make them less deadly. Let me just give you one example, and that is the cigarette has been designed to be inhalable, and it's actually the inhalation which creates the lung cancer and the chronic obstructive lung disease. And they're inhalable because the cigarette pH is kept very neutral and very mild. And with Native Americans smoked cigarettes, they actually smoked a much harsher tobacco that was not inhalable, and so they didn't have the same lung cancer epidemic we have. So the cigarette is actually defective in the sense that it could be made much less deadly, but the industry simply chooses not to.
And you point out that cigarettes are a relatively recent phenomenon in the history of the use of tobacco, as you were beginning to say there. And it was basically not till the very end of the 19th century that cigarettes were basically used at all. Before then, it was pipe and cigars. And as you were saying, the pH of those were such that they were not inhalable. But people would derive the nicotine because it is very absorbable through the mucous membranes in the mouth. Is that correct?
That's exactly right. Yeah, the very high pH smoke, as you say, from pipes and cigars, freebases the nicotine to such an extent that it goes right through the mucosal membranes of the mouth, and so gives you the nicotine punch without going to the lungs. And the industry invented low pH tobacco curing methods in the 19th century, and that allowed smoke to be inhaled for the very first time without coughing. And so there's a kind of irony there, because it was actually thought that this milder tobacco that was being used in cigarettes was safer because it was less harsh. But in fact, it was much more deadly because it was so easily inhaled. The other thing, you point out that cigarettes were rarely smoked, and that's right, because in 1900, there's only 2.5 billion cigarettes smoked in the United States. And by 1982, there's 630 billion. So you go from 2 billion to 630 billion over the course of the 20th century.
Yeah, you give a very startling image that these days there are 6 trillion cigarettes manufactured every year, or smoked every year, you say. I'm quoting you now.
Yeah.
Enough to make a continuous chain from the Earth to the Sun and back, with enough left over for a couple of round trips to Mars when the planet is at the near-Earth orbit. So that, imagine one long rod that would be a cigarette more than 300 million miles long. That's what's being produced and inhaled on this planet every year now. That's just mind-boggling.
Yeah, there's even another way to think about it. That 300 million miles of cigarettes produced and smoked every year, that means that cigarettes are actually being smoked at a rate faster than satellites orbit the Earth. In other words, we have this myth that people don't smoke anymore, and it's just that, a myth. The industry is constructed basically to make themselves invisible. And so we don't probe it, and people go on puffing away, and it's, as I say, the deadliest artifact in the history of human civilization, and we do essentially nothing about it.
Yes, we're speaking with Professor Robert Proctor about his book, Golden Holocaust, Origins of the Cigarette Catastrophe and the Case for Abolition. You alluded to the science and chemistry of cigarette production. I think most of us just figure, oh, it's just tobacco, roll it up in some paper, and there's not much you can do about it, but they actually freebase it. Explain about that.
Well, the cigarette is actually among the most carefully designed small objects on the planet. Literally tens of billions of dollars have been invested by the tobacco industry in making it a perfect consumer product, a perfect addicting engine. And one of the techniques they use is they add ammonia to freebase the tobacco. And what's going on there is that with the sort of push to lighter, ever lighter cigarettes, they wanted to make sure they were sufficiently addictive. And so they freebased the smoke by adding ammonia and other bases to create the nicotine molecule in a free state, which would mean it would go much more rapidly to your brain within a matter of about 6 to 8 seconds, actually, and create this increased potency. And actually, the same techniques were used to freebase cocaine in the 1970s, but the industry had actually invented this in the late 1950s, and I call it crack nicotine. They basically invented the whole freebasing technology, and there's some interesting examples of it in prehistory. A number of native peoples will urinate on tobacco in order to add the urea or the ammonia, and they do it not knowing why, but it increases the potency. The same base, so I call that folk freebasing. But the industry developed this in its chemical laboratories in the 60s, and it's the main reason that Marlboro is the world's leading cigarette, is because they developed and perfected that freebasing technique.
And another invention was the flu curing, which you say is the deadliest invention in history, basically. You point out that gunpowder and nukes have killed fewer people. As we said before, 100 million people dead in the 20th century from cigarettes. Gunpowder and nukes, bad as they are, were less than that.
Yeah, much less. I mean, as I say, 100 million people in the 20th century, that's mostly from the making cigarettes inhalable. And that's from the development of flu curing, which is actually a technique accidentally invented by a slave in the 1830s. The story is he was tending the fires in a curing barn, and the fire went out, so he rushed out and got some charcoal and threw it on the fire, and the fire burned much hotter, and it heated the leaves to a higher temperature than it had ever been heated before, and that basically disabled the enzymatic destruction process, and it stopped the sugars from being degraded in the tobacco. And when you have high sugar tobacco, what that does is when you burn it, it produces acids and it neutralizes the nicotine alkaloid and produces this very mild inhalable smoke. And that's what actually made it possible to inhale cigarette smoke, was that technique of high temperature flue curing. And it's called flues because the heat was transmitted through flue conduits, pipes. And as a result, all cigarettes now use that method, and it's why they're inhalable, and it's why people get lung cancer.
Now, let's not forget that whether you smoke a pipe or chew tobacco or have cigars, that still is cancer-producing, just not lung cancer-producing. Does that also have the cardio effects that cigarettes have?
Sure. Yeah. The tobacco is a pretty awful drug. I mean, it's especially when you combust it, even in the form of a pipe. That's actually how the first tobacco cancers were discovered. Already in the 18th century, people were observing that pipe smokers got lip cancer, mouth cancer. Even chewing tobacco, of course, gives you all kinds of mouth cancer, and it's essentially epidemic in baseball and football and many other sports. So there's a lot of other nasties. The cigarette exceeds those in particular, but there's a lot of nasty stuff you get with the other tobacco.
You know, Robert, I'm having a little trouble hearing you. If you could speak a bit louder and more directly into your microphone, that would help me.
Okay.
Thank you. Now, there are many other technical things that have been attempted in redesigning cigarette filters, for one thing, different kinds of filters, ventilation, and I think it may surprise people to learn that far from being less deadly, you maintain cigarettes are actually more deadly now than they were before all of this fancification happened. Explain how and why that is.
Well, filters, for example, are completely fraudulent. They don't actually filter at all. They're sort of like smoking speed bumps, or it's more like combing your hair. You don't lose your hair when you comb it. And the filters are completely fraudulent. All they really do is make people think they're safer, and as a result, reassure people. And so people who might have quit continue smoking with filters. But filters also reduce the particle size of the smoke, and as a result, the smoke penetrates deeper into the lungs and actually causes cancers that are harder to operate and harder to detect or diagnose. And the other thing is that people, since they're addicted, they smoke their cigarettes in order to get a certain dose of nicotine, and that means that if the cigarette is smaller, they'll smoke it more intensively to get their nicotine. And so cigarettes today are actually smoked more intensively than they were in the past. And so gram per gram, they're probably about twice as deadly as they were 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so smokers compensate for these sorts of efforts to reduce the delivery of nicotine, you make a distinction between the content, the nicotine content, and the delivery. You go into great detail in your book about the ways that the science was manipulated to derive statistics that would make it appear that they're more healthful, but in fact they're not.
Right, Joe. There was this effort to make low tar cigarettes and light cigarettes as if these were safer, and a number of governments actually wanted to tax cigarettes according to how much tar they produced. But the whole low tar idea was a myth, because people adjust their smoking behavior, as you said, according to how addicted they are. And it really has relatively little to do with how the cigarette is constructed. And so people just smoke so-called low-tar and light cigarettes more intensively, getting just as much tar and nicotine. And what people don't realize is that the low-tar and the light cigarettes had just as high a percentage of nicotine, because that's why people smoke. The industry has realized for decades people smoke for the nicotine because they're addicted. It's not a recreational drug. And so the low tars are no less deadly.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, there are all of the other chemical components in cigarettes that are very deadly. I think most people are not aware that there is radioactive polonium in cigarettes, depending on where the tobacco has been grown, that there is more or less. Obviously, that's bad news, but it's also extremely bad news because the tendency for it to deposit in areas where there is like a joint in the bronchial passages. Explain about that and why industry ways of explaining how that's not a problem are very, very deceptive.
Yes, the radioactivity comes mainly from the fertilizers used on the plant, the so-called superphosphates, which concentrate uranium, and then this produces a decay product to radioactive lead, and then lead to polonium, and this is then trapped in the leaves, and it's rolled up in cigarettes. And smokers don't know this, but it's actually the main form of radioactivity to which humans are exposed is actually through cigarettes. And what happens is the radioactivity is trapped in the tars, and then these are deposited, as you said, on the bronchial bifurcations. And that's actually where most of the cancers end up starting to grow. And the radioactivity is deposited there, and the lungs are not able to clean themselves because they've been damaged. The little cilia that normally clean your lungs have been damaged by the other garbage in the cigarettes, and that means that you can't clear your lungs, so those alpha radiations just continue on in your lungs. And the tobacco industry has known about this for decades, and they've refused, we know from their secret documents, that they refuse to publicize it for fear of what they say, they don't want to wake a sleeping giant. And that's what polonium is called. They call it the sleeping giant. They don't want to be awakened, because if ordinary smokers knew there was radioactivity, maybe they'd be less, eager about smoking.
Mm-hmm. Are there any other... Oh, yeah, there is one more thing before we move on to other topics about this. There are... Well, everybody knows there are poisonous substances in tobacco besides nicotine, which is a poison. When it was first discovered in 1820s in Germany, that it was found that one drop of the nicotine alcohol alloyed was enough to kill a dog, and several were enough to kill a horse. It was deleted from the U.S. Pharmacopeia in the end of the 19th century, and then excluded from the Pure Food and Drug Act of 1906, which created the FDA.
Right. Well,
is there anything you want to add about specific poisons before we move on to the more cultural aspects of this?
Oh, yeah. I mean, my book has a whole set of chapters called Radiant Filth and Redemption about the ungodly mess of chemicals and garbage that's actually in cigarettes, things you wouldn't believe, things like castoreum, which is a secretion from the anal glands of the Siberian beaver, and all kinds of other unbelievable compounds. But, you know, when you say everybody knows, of course, not everybody knows, and we shouldn't, the mentally retarded smoke. You know, there are a lot of people who don't know. You know, when I talk to groups of professors, I'll ask, you know, what's the most deadly radioactive isotope in cigarette smoke? And no one will know. So basically, we live in this world of massive ignorance. And the other important thing is we live in what I would call a kind of world of radical tobacco exceptionalism. You know, in the 1950s, there were five different butter yellow synthetic dyes that were banned because they were carcinogenic. There was far greater evidence that tobacco was killing many more people than this butter yellow, but the power of the industry allowed this radical tobacco exceptionalism, and so it just kept going. They've managed to basically escape from every form of regulatory oversight. And so, you know, poisons that you would never allow if they were invented today are routinely allowed, we basically grandfathered in the cigarette.
Hmm. In fact, you point out that the tobacco industry is itself a disease vector, that there are 500 million deaths projected from those alive today because of the tobacco industry, and perhaps as many as a billion smokers worldwide. If they were mosquitoes, there would be programs to try to eradicate them. But one of the reasons that they don't have to suffer this sort of treatment is taxation, not just in the United States, but around the world. Would you talk about taxation and its role in promoting and allowing this deadly industry to continue?
Yeah, I call it the second addiction. And basically, throughout the world, finance ministries rely on tobacco taxes to prop up their governments. And this has been substantial. For example, about 10% of the entire Nazi economy, I mean, Germany in the 30s and 40s, was just tobacco taxes. The financial revenues to the government, 10%, were from tobacco taxes. In England in 1950, 20% of the entire governmental revenue was from tobacco taxes. In the 1880s, the United States, a third of the entire governmental revenue was from tobacco taxes. So this sets up a massive dependency on continuing this cash cow. It's like they're milking this cow. And so there's a disincentive, a kind of conflict of interest. And that's why, basically, even though health ministries throughout the world don't like tobacco, finance ministries love it.
And even in China, you point out that there are probably about 15 people in the entire country actively working on preventing smoking and smoking cessation, and 15 million people working in the tobacco industry. And you went so far as to say that it's part of the government plan not to have to provide for the elderly, to have a certain number of them die off before they're old.
Yeah, I call it the end of filial piety in China. It's part of Chinese modernization, socialism with a Chinese face, and they've used this to generate massive revenue. When I first started working on it, 12% of the Chinese economy was, of the Chinese governmental revenue, was based on was from cigarette taxes, and now it's down to around 7 or 8%. But China is trying to become the world's global tobacco superpower. They now produce 2.4 trillion cigarettes, which is 40% of the world's total. They want to export these to Africa and the rest of the world. And so they're participating in this just like the West.
We are speaking with Professor Robert Proctor about his latest book, Golden Holocaust, Origins of the Cigarette Catastrophe and the Case for Abolition. You're listening to Forthright Radio. I'm Joy LeClaire. I've heard people talk about this on other programs, and particularly those who want to quit and aren't able to, and the lack of facilities that there are to help people who do want to end. In an article in the Los Angeles Times, scrambling to address budget problems, states this year will spend less than 2% of their tobacco tax and tobacco settlement billions on programs to help people quit smoking or prevent them from starting in the first place, according to a recent report by a coalition of public health organizations. In the last 4 years, state spending on tobacco prevention and cessation has declined by 36%. And we know it's very, very difficult to do that. People who are trying, who are smokers and are trying, they have my compassion. Now, to the issue of part of that settlement involves the industry putting out commercials, advertisements to appeal to young people to try to prevent them from beginning to smoke. You do a very good job, Robert Proctor, of showing those programs are. Give a few examples of how and why not only don't they work, but they actually end up promoting cigarettes.
Well, I begin the book with a story from my own high school where some guy came in from the tobacco industry and said, look, smoking is not for you kids. It's like driving a motorcycle or having sex or drinking alcohol, things that you're not supposed to do. You're supposed to wait. And I talk about this as, you know, it's classic tempting by forbidding fruit. And forbidden fruit is what the industry wants to say that this is to kids. They actually call it acceptable rebellion is how they think about cigarettes, that it's a way for kids to do legitimate rebellion. So the fact that cigarettes are naughty or bad for you is actually used by the industry as an enticement. You know, no one smokes to look younger. You know, kids start smoking to look older, and it's the very sort of danger of it, which and the adult and the forbidden nature, which is appealing. And that's once they get hooked, it's too late.
And as I promised at the beginning of the show, you have chapter after chapter after chapter talking about how the tobacco industry has invaded our culture and created our culture. One of the most startling was that the very way shirts are made is designed, the shirt pocket is designed specifically to be able to hold a pack of cigarettes.
Yeah, the cigarette has invaded our culture so much. Think about the ashtray, the ashtrays which are actually given out by the tobacco industry to facilitate smoking. I mean, these penetrated every part of culture. There were ashtrays on every airplane, in every airplane seat, in every car, cigarette lighters in every car, the electronic brain to control World War III, the Sage computer, had an ashtray built right into it that you could use while, you know, governing Armageddon. And so the cigarette became this invasive force, and that's why I think it's essentially so common as to become invisible Whereas if you were to invent it now, you'd seem kind of like a crazy person.
Yes. And how many of us went through the early years of school without making an ashtray to give to our parents in some sort of craft project? I know I sure did. And it was just what was done. It was that unthought of as part of the culture. Now, cigarette tobacco, big tobacco, makes a big deal about philanthropy. And you talk about music promotion, sports promotion. You talk about the class analysis of how different brands appeal to different sectors. The psychology behind all this is just mind-blowing. Just take a few minutes to share with our listeners about that sort of thing, and then we will open the lines to our listeners.
Well, they've done what they call brand segmentation. There's special marketing projects to appeal to Jews, special cigarettes designed to appeal to blacks. They've marketed to what they call lazy greens and lesbians and the so-called scum market in San Francisco, the subculture urban marketing. They've marketed to the homeless. They've basically followed that philosophy, you know, they got lips, we want them, is what they say in one document. And the effort, you know, in trapping and harnessing thousands of scholars and scientists to improve this marketing technique is really, really phenomenal.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know I just promised we'd open the phones, and we will, but I want to introduce one more element, and that's the environmental elements. You point out that item by item, the most polluting waste is cigarette butts. In the United States alone, 68,000 tons of cigarette butts filters, and those are actually considered toxic waste, and yet they're just strewn all over the place. The other thing is the sustainability of a tobacco environment. I think we think that it's not growing every year, the amount of arable land put into tobacco production. I always thought it was just Maryland, Virginia, North Carolina, maybe Kentucky were producing it. But on a global scale, is it sustainable?
Well, it's definitely not sustainable. It's tobacco growing is a leading cause of deforestation, not just for making the crop, but also for making the charcoal that you need to flue cure it. It's also a major consumer of pesticides, of paper. It's a huge consumer, even if you think about advertising. You know, you have journals like journals like Wired and Mother Jones doing cigarette ads. And, you know, that uses up paper, uses up ink, there's the massive transport, and there's even fires. The cigarettes are the major cause of fires. And a lot of the biggest industrial accidents are from fire-caused cigarettes. So cigarettes are very unsustainable, and they are actually significant causes of global warming.
Okay, now I'm going to keep the promise to open the phone lines, even though I could hold you for another few hours discussing your book, Robert Proctor. If you want to join this conversation, give us a call at 895-2448 in the 707 area code. And let's see, there's so many things to talk about here. Oh, well, what you were just saying in terms of advertising, the industry is still allowed to have advertising in magazines. And it's no secret that with the dwindling resources that alternative magazines like Mother Jones, for example, how likely are they to run exposés about this issue and possibly alienate one of their sources of revenues?
That's been historically the big problem. There's a lot of evidence that the more tobacco ads a magazine runs, the less likely they are to report on the hazards of smoking. And that was particularly true of women's magazines. And Gloria Steinem actually called it a kind of prison for Ms. Magazine, that they took so many tobacco ads they felt they really couldn't report honestly on the hazards.
Yes. Now, you say that you are making a case for abolition. Do you mean that you want to see tobacco made illegal?
I would like to see cigarettes not be sold or produced. And I distinguish that from prohibition. In other words, people should have the right to smoke whatever they want in their own home, as long as it doesn't hurt other people. I even grow tobacco in my front yard, and I don't think the government has any right to say what you should or shouldn't smoke. If you want to grow your own tobacco and cure it, that's fine. It's just the cigarette as it's presently made is too dangerous, and I think it should not be sold.
Troy, we have a call.
Well, let's take this caller.
Caller, you're on the air.
Yeah, I wanted to ask the speaker,
Speak up, please.
Studies on tobacco. Did he ever see,
excuse me, I'm sorry, listener, I cannot hear you. Would you please speak up?
Can you hear me now?
Yes, that's much better. Begin again, please.
Yeah, I was wondering, in the speaker, in his studies, did he run across when the Native Americans used tobacco for farming to keep pests from eating the corn? Did he ever run into that?
What was the question exactly?
Repeat the question and speak as loudly as possible.
In your studies, did you come across Native Americans using tobacco for farming to deter pests from eating their corn?
Thank you, listener.
No, I didn't run across that. I do know that nicotine has very often been used as a pesticide. And, in fact, that's one of the most common pesticides from the 1930s and 40s. And so I wouldn't be surprised if that was used that way, because it is such a powerful poison.
Mm-hmm. And you say you grow it yourself. Do you do it as an ornamental, or do you actually smoke what you grow?
No, I grow it just as an ornamental. But again, if someone wants to grow it and smoke it, I have no problem with that.
Mm-hmm. And now, let's see. You end your book with what you say are solutions, 10 of which you say are obvious and 10 that are less obvious. Why don't you run down some of those for our listeners?
Well, some of the more obvious ones are things like there shouldn't be tobacco advertising and things like that. But, you know, we often talk about quitting consumption, but we never talk about quitting production. And that's the some of the less obvious ones are we've got to move to a situation where we take the nicotine out of cigarettes, for example. That could be easily done, and then cigarettes would not be addictive. And
take a moment, Robert, and explain how that's done. It's actually not done by a chemical process, is it?
You mean taking the nicotine out?
Yeah.
You can do it many different ways. There are a lot of, just like marijuana, there are a lot of nicotine-free plants, you know, tobacco plants. So plants will range from 0 to 10% nicotine by weight, and you can selectively choose. In fact, that's how the industry manipulates the nicotine content of its tobacco, mainly is by choosing particular varieties of plants, and then different leaves on the plant also have different levels of nicotine, and the most nicotine is in the top parts of the plant. So they can manipulate that quite easily.
Yeah, of course.
Oh, let's take this next caller.
You want the air caller?
Good morning, Joy. Robert.
Good morning.
Well,
yes. Hello.
Hello. 50 years is a long time.
Excuse me, we're having a hard time hearing. Are the levels up as high as possible?
Yes.
Okay, listeners who call in, please make an effort to speak very loudly and directly into your mouthpieces. Thank you.
Okay, can you hear me?
Barely.
Wow. Well, I just wanted to call and say I've been an addict 50 years now, about, and today's as good a day to stop again as any. And so all credit to your show. It's been very informative. I'm really incensed about the corporate aspect of this, and so I really do appreciate the show this morning.
Well, thank you, Robert. Were you able to hear that?
Yeah, the caller makes an extremely important point, which is that if smokers realize that really they're being fooled by a massive industry, that's one of the best ways to actually help quitting. We have to realize that the industry is quite a big bully. For example, the military, U.S. military, tried to go smoke-free in the 1980s. And what happened was the tobacco industry got their friends in Congress to actually write a law that says that all naval ships have to sell cigarettes and have to allow smoking. And so United States submarines didn't go smoke-free until 2011. And again, you're talking about one of the world's biggest bullies, and becoming aware of that can actually help people quit.
Of course.
Let's take this next caller.
Caller, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you so much for this show. I'm another addict. I've struggled on and off since I was, 15 or something. So, yeah, getting on 50 years. And so, yeah, this is more inspiring. And yet I still feel like I need help. So I guess I'd have one question, which would be, what is the real effective help? And the other things that I would like to say, I think the feeling of shame, what you were talking about, that and people judging smokers that actually would love to be able to quit, this is hearing you guys talk about this is empowering me. And so I would just like to say to all the other smokers out there listening, please do not take on the shame. You're important. Your life is important. And please don't be ashamed. Get the help you need to quit. Don't take on other people's judgment. And then I would also like to say to the people that judge others for smoking, every time you have a thought, a negative thought about someone that smokes or is addicted to cigarettes, take that energy and use it politically. Tell somebody else. Stop the shaming and do something to help us. That's all. Thank you.
Thank you, caller. And do stay tuned to the end of the show because I am going to be giving out information where smokers can get help for free. So do stay tuned later on. Robert, do you have anything you want to say to that listener?
No, I think what she's made is an extremely important point. There's no shame in smoking at all. The shame is what the tobacco industry has done to smokers. You know, and, you know, in my book, the people who are starting to reading it, I'm getting lots of responses from people saying it's helping them quit because they see how much manipulation there's been. They see the catastrophic environmental effects of smoking. The anti-smoking movement has tended to very often be paternalistic. And when we look at these, and that's a big problem, but there certainly is no shame in smoking. The problem is with the industry, not the smokers.
Yeah, of course.
Yes, we'll take this call. I want to do let the person come on, but before you start speaking, caller, I want to get out the information. There is something, X campaign, EX, and it's said to be an excellent science-based tool for smokers who want to quit, says Thomas Glynn, Director of Cancer Science and Trends for the American Cancer Society. Another option is a national toll-free line, 1-800-QUIT-NOW, Q-U-I-T-N-O-W. which routes callers to free support services, including free medication in the handful of states that provide it. I'll repeat that at the end of the show. Now, thank you for being patient, caller. What do you want to say?
Hello, is that me?
That's you.
Yeah, I just wondered if you could speak to menthol cigarettes and their, well, it seems like they're marketed to African Americans in this country particularly, and boy, they're in the weird chemistry of cigarettes there, especially odd, so I'd love it if you could speak to that. And this has been an amazing show. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you. And Robert Proctor goes into great depth about the issue of menthol. Take it, Robert.
Yeah, the menthols have been marketed to African Americans since the 1960s. And there's actually a horrific racist document from Lorillard that talks about how menthols may be used by African Americans to cover up what they call their racial genetic smell. And you can't believe this. I'm not making it up, but the tobacco industry has marketed to African-Americans intensively. And, in fact, one of the Winston men, when he was trying to get some cigarettes, asked Reynolds if he could have the free packs from a photo shoot. And they said, oh, yeah, we don't smoke, and we reserve that right for the poor, the black, and the stupid. And menthols, they basically help the poison go down easier, and they make it easier to inhale, they make it easier to start smoking, and as a result, it's even though it doesn't directly add to the harm, it actually certainly makes it harder to quit and makes it easier to start.
And as you pointed out, in the recent laws have been put into a place, tobacco industry cannot use candy flavorings, and menthol was the exception to that. Let's take our next caller.
Caller, you're on the air.
Hi. I'd just like to say, because of the permissive attitude about marijuana here in Mendocino County, marijuana is revered almost like a god. An interesting phenomenon is that smoke shops are popping up all over this county and elsewhere, and they sell all kinds of cute little accessories for smoking marijuana, and I would just like to ask, isn't this encouraging people to smoke, and isn't it opening the door to more smoking of any kind of thing? I mean, smoking itself can't be good for the lungs in any way, and anyways, marijuana is treated like a god.
Okay, I think we got your point, and
yeah.
We're running out of time.
Okay, thank you.
Let's let Robert respond.
Okay, bye-bye.
Well, a related problem is all the hookah shops bringing up in college campuses everywhere, and I asked my undergraduates, you know, why do you smoke hookah, and do you know what hookah is? And they don't even know there's tobacco in it often, and so there's a huge amount of ignorance about, you know, putting poisons into your lungs.
We have more calls.
Well, I'm sorry, but I think that one more call, and let's make it very brief.
Could you please discuss the link between Big Tobacco and the Tea Party?
Well, I haven't gone into detail.
Robert? Did we just lose Robert?
I think we did.
Oh, I'm so sorry. But, well, obviously, this has been a very interesting show for many people. I recommend that you get this book, Golden Holocaust, Origins of the Cigarette Catastrophe and the Case for Abolition, just out by University of California Press. Robert Proctor, Stanford History of Science professor. It's a huge book. It's 735 pages, very well documented. If you want to wait for it to be at the library, request it from the library, but inform yourself. Now, as promised, the smoking cessation information is the X campaign, the EX campaign. It's an excellent science-based tool for smokers who want to quit. Another option, I'm sure you can go online and find out about that. Another option is a national toll-free line, 1-800-QUIT-NOW, which routes callers to free support services, including free medication in the handful of states that provide it. The 2010 federal health law expanded coverage for smoking cessation, though not to the degree that advocates wanted. Under the law, states must provide free tobacco cessation coverage for all pregnant women in their Medicaid programs, but anti-smoking activists would like to broader Medicaid coverage requirements. Although 19% of adults smoke overall, 31% of those living below the poverty line are smokers. And the health law also requires that new health plans, those that have either just begun or have changed their benefits sufficiently to lose their grandfathered status under the law, screen adults for tobacco use and provide free smoking cessation interventions. So that hotline number is 1-800-QUIT-NOW. Thank you all for listening. Forthright Radio is a Beyond the Deep End production, broadcast each first and third Wednesday of the month from the Philo Studios of KZYXNZ, Mendocino County Public Broadcasting. Engineer Ann Newport. I'm Joy LeClaire. Forthright Radio is made possible by a grant from the Alice and Alfred Adler Memorial Trust with assistance from the Rocky Mountain Peace and Justice Center. And you can always contact us by emailing forthrightradio@gmail.com. A fortnight from today, Forthright Radio returns with Gloria Felt. We'll be discussing the ideas in her book, No Excuses, 9 Ways Women Can Change the Way They Think About Power, Tools for Leading an Unlimited Life.